A new centrist party in Britain as the Brexit crisis rumbles on. The electoral coalition to deliver a radical political agenda suddenly looks in peril. This hasn't been an easy week for left radical remainers. So how do we beat the centrists, deliver the socialist programme that Britain urgently needs, and stop Brexit? These are the questions we're discussing today with me, Zoe Williams from The Guardian, Luke Cooper, a visiting fellow at the IWM in Vienna, and Elena Ivanova from the Another Europe office. This is the Another Europe is Possible position at this perilous yet strangely possibility-stacked moment in the Brexit catastrophe. I'm going to break with tradition completely here and say exactly what we're going to talk about as well in this podcast.
Yeah.
We're going to discuss what's happened this week because there's been a lot of it. We're going to discuss where the opportunities are for our agenda, that is to say, stopping Brexit. And we're going to discuss the possible threats to those opportunities. It's going to end very upbeat, trust me, but it might be a bit fiddly as we go through it. So, Luke, update us. What has happened this week?
Well, the big news this week is that we've had the split in the Labour Party, followed swiftly by the split in the Tory Party. So we had 8 MPs from Labour leaving the party over a combination of different reasons, but Brexit was front and centre. And then the next day we had the magnificent 3 of Tory MPs who were jumping ship too. And that was a big game changer because there was always this talk over the last 3 years, for as long as Corbyn was in power, that will Labour split? Will the old Blairites jump ship and form a new centrist party? But maybe there hasn't been as much attention paid to the crisis that was also enveloping the Conservative Party through this whole period. And the language that these Tory MPs are using is just really quite incredible, you know, saying that the party has been taken over by an ERG group, that's the implications sort of backed by dark money, increasingly nationalistic party, that the Conservative Party is in UK, this mainstream organisation has become almost this populist party. That was interesting. And this morning, I don't know when we're going to broadcast, but the latest development is that Ian Austin has also left. However, this is unlike the other splits in the important sense that the rest of this group is united by being opposed to Brexit, and maybe not united by that much else apart from that. But Ian Austin is one of the pro-Brexit Labour MPs that has left over Corbyn and anti-Semitism. So it does seem to be a really extraordinary big moment in post-war British history, because this is a time when the two parties have split simultaneously. And so that's very different from the formation of the SDP in the early 1980s, where that was clearly a split in the Labour Party. And so this is a sort of coalition of Blairism, Cameronism, Osborneism that's kind of emerging in the political centre, Cleggism in the political centre.
I mean, I think exactly in that description, you have the problem of it. They don't seem to believe in anything. When you look at the mission statement of the independent group, or TIG, as we call it, they say they split over Europe, but they don't even mention Europe. And they say they split over anti-Semitism, but when they actually come out with their statement, their first priority is national security. It's the most ridiculous statement I've ever read. We don't need to be attacked from outside. We're destroying each other. It would actually be really useful. You know, I don't think they have a coherent political agenda. I don't think being joined by Anna Soubry helps with that as their critical problem, because all the Tories who've joined them have been consistently pro-austerity. So if they were painting themselves as the kind of kind face of anti-austerity, then that's torpedoed that. So in a sense, politically, they're a bit Liz Kendall. You know, I'm against everything apart from something that I'm not going to attack. It's just kind of modernity. And kind of interestingly, of the original 7 Labour MPs who left, 5 of them had voted for Liz Kendall as leader. I didn't know that there was anybody. I mean, I couldn't name the people who voted for Liz Kendall beforehand.
Now you can.
Now I can.
Yeah, the thing is, I've heard this. I know this is being said a lot in the media this week, that they, you know, they don't really have anything that holds them together. But I'm just not sure about that. Is there such a huge difference between what Cameron stood for and what Blair stood for, well, really? Is there such a huge difference between the centre-right and the centre-left in the neoliberal period?
What I mean, there isn't is an animation, right? So you might say the centre-right and the centre-left don't have very much different, don't have very much to choose between politically. But actually, what they have is a kind of optimism and vision and hope difference. So it's very difficult for somebody on the left to articulate a hopeful narrative around cuts to welfare and pro-businessiness, because all of that kind of language belongs to the right. When they had the Labour leadership election and everybody was like, Jeremy Corbyn is so, he's so unrealistic, he's such a war horse. But actually, if you tried to nail down a positive vision from any of the other candidates, you couldn't see it, because it's very hard for the left to be positive and be Blairite. You know, Blair got away with it because he actually was, if you look back at 97, the programme was quite Corbyn-y. But anyway,
this, and the slogan as well.
Yeah.
What depressed me about this week is that, you know, we've been a load of column inches talking about the seven and whether they would amount to anything, which I don't think they will, and the Tories joining them and what that meant for the future of the parties. It doesn't seem to me to have any real implication for Brexit, except in the sense that they become de facto the DUP, in the sense that they've got casting vote, but only for the Tories, not for the Labour Party.
It's really interesting what you were talking about in terms of the hopeful message, because I think the one thing that kind of came through with the whole announcement was we all expect the people coming from the Blair tradition to be very on message and to, you know, to nail down the message and then keep going on about it. And Brexit didn't seem to be that message. Like, it was all, it actually, from the Labour grouping in that independent group, it was all quite downcast. Like, they were talking about new politics, but there was nothing new coming through, and there was no vision of an alternative project they're trying to set up. So it was kind of stillborn, even in its first public expression, this split. And it's, to me, that's quite interesting, because they've been talking about this for so long and they've been planning this for so long. It almost feels like, I don't know, that like Chuka was hoping for a very different grouping to be standing alongside him.
I thought
up there.
That his body language was interesting, because he didn't look as happy as the others. I think he's very nervous about losing his seat, and justifiably so. Yeah. I'm not sure if I agree with that, because I think what they've got to do and what they are doing is be a populist party in a way, a weird type of populism in the political centre. But I mean the sort of, I guess, more long-standing definition of populism, which is, hey, we're neither left nor right, we're ahead, you know, with the way in which Blair was kind of populist sort of leader. Mm. And I think they get that in the sense that they don't want to nail their mast to being Tory or being Labour, but they're new. So they have to promote this kind of cult of novelty and hoover up voters who are annoyed with both parties. And to be honest, I suspect they've got a pretty decent chance of doing that.
Well,
and
I
think it will affect the Brexit debate in quite a big way.
In what way?
Well, I think the main specific difference now is that it puts massive pressure on Labour to pivot to a pro-Remain stance.
I don't know if that...
Now got this anti-Brexit
challenge. Because that's exactly the thing, isn't it? It cuts completely both ways. It puts pressure on them in the sense that they could close down the independent group tomorrow if they just came out really strongly against Brexit. That would be the end of their oxygen. But you have to remember how incredibly stubborn and bunkerish the leadership has become, and the more open the pressure on them and the more that pressure comes from the people they classically don't like, i.e. Chuka, I really felt anxious that it would just bake them into their position. People always say the danger is the way you won an election gets to be the way you think you win everything. And Corbyn won the leadership by ignoring the parliamentary party, ignoring, you know, media pressure, ignoring polling and good sense arguments and all the rest of it, and just going straight for his perception of what people want. And so I worry that this actually just reinforces that, you know, we were born ignoring Chukwuemeka, we will die ignoring Chukwuemeka. And in a way, I was quite pleased that they didn't say anything about Europe in their mission statement, because it felt like in their attempt to make their offer broader than just Europe, they neutralised their own threat to kind of reinforce Corbyn's fixity on Europe.
Did you catch Chris Leslie's comments about what his economic programme would be?
Oh,
that was very like revealing. It was like no top rate of tax, no abolition of tuition fees and fiscal constraint.
He's absolutely bonkers. Completely bonkers. I mean,
let's be really unpopular.
Yeah. I know. And actually, that's the one thing that Corbyn really, really cleaned up on. always tuition fees.
Yeah.
But also the whole nationalization issue where, like, he published that thing in the New Statesman where he said, oh, well, I know that nationalization is hugely popular, but I don't care because it's not desirable.
I mean, that's, you got to credit the honesty of it.
Exactly.
Fine. I mean, I think the important thing from my point of view is, what are our chances of a second vote, and where and how do we get there? Because there's a sense in which this grouping has increased the likelihood of a general election because they've increased the likelihood of the Tory party imploding. There's a sense in which they've increased the likelihood of a second referendum being called by Theresa May, which is what people thought might happen 6 weeks ago. But I'm kind of bored of hitching my apple wagon to those ideas because they never come about. What is the only way towards a second referendum if it's not those two ways? What I want to know is there a realistic and practical route between us and ditching Brexit? And what is that route? We're not trying to sell this to other people now. We're trying to ask whether it's even possible.
I mean, this feels like it's a question that, yeah, as you say, we keep asking ourselves week after week, and there's something different happens in Parliament, and then there's a clever little twist and something is salvaged out of the crash and burn that happens in the chamber in the House of Commons. And I think we're once again at that stage, aren't we? We're still very much dependent on parliamentary process. As much as we go on about the general message is there, and I think the general message, we will drill down further and it will become more refined. It will become also broader in a way, having the independence. But in terms of the practical steps, they're still very much contained in parliamentary process.
Yeah.
Which I think feels very daunting for people at this point.
So which bits of parliamentary process should we be supporting and applauding?
Well, we're in a new situation, I guess, this week compared to, was it 2 or 3 weeks ago when the defeat of the Cooper-Bowles amendment? I think that was a big blow because it was a big lurch towards no-deal Brexit,
but essentially. But I wasn't even that excited about the Cooper-Bowles amendment because all it gave was a provision for extension anyway, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess that's why people found it demoralising, because if you can't even get that, then are you ever going to get the next thing? But I mean, this week, all of the attention is focused now on the ratification amendment. This would provide a way out for Theresa May, and that's how it's being pitched, by saying, look, Parliament will back your deal, but only in the event that you commit to a referendum. So you put your deal to the people, and then if the people say yes to the deal, then it immediately becomes law. The procedure of this does work, because I know there's always a feeling that Theresa May could just go back on her promise. But what the lawyers are saying is that, well, she can't really do that in this case, because you need not one but two votes to deliver Brexit. So there's like an implementation vote afterwards.
And this ratification amendment, just in a practical sense, would Parliament vote on that the same day as they voted on the withdrawal agreement?
Well, the ratification amendment's up for a vote next Wednesday.
Oh, okay, great. And who's it got? Has it got any Tories, and has it got the left of Labour? And who doesn't it have?
The actual specific text is not available yet, but it's being talked about a lot. So I think there's some discussion around exactly what it's going to say and who exactly is going to sign up to it. I think from our perspective, it's really important to have credible left figures in the Labour Party who are backing that amendment, including some front benchers. But more importantly, too, it needs to have the support of the Labour front bench to have any hope. Mm. And there is increasing belief, although it's not confirmed at the time of the podcast, that the Labour front bench will support the amendment.
And will they whip for it?
Yeah, I mean, so they have to whip for it. I mean, not whipping for it is as good as not supporting it.
In terms of what kind of pressure everybody outside Parliament can put on. Is there anything we can do at this point?
Yeah, I mean, people are quite disenchanted with the methods of representation they get currently. And if anything, again, the split has highlighted certain issues around who exactly am I voting for and what kind of mandate I'm giving them when I send them to Parliament. But if ever there was a time when it was a good idea to contact your MP and try and discuss what's going on, I would say now's the time. You know, people are rightly doubtful about how much influence they have over their elected representative. But we're seeing evidence that it works, pressure works, and, you know, a personalized approach, but also just sheer numbers can change this. You're talking about a very volatile situation where people supportive of the leadership, but also people with various criticisms of the leadership, especially in the Labour Party, will be thinking, well, actually, what's going to happen to my seat? How likely am I to get elected again and all the rest of it? And it is now that they will be keen to listen to constituents and to people contacting them about this, I think. It doesn't feel like parliamentarians at this point are very keen on, you know, shouldering the whole burden of responsibility with Brexit. I think they really would like a stronger mandate from the people they represent.
Yeah. Zoe has a conceptual belief that MPs never listen to their constituents. Well, but I think they do, actually.
Yeah, but listen, I'm in Kate Hoey's constituency, so you can see why I would be filled with a crushing disenchantment and disgust, actually. But, you know, that is just Kate Hoey. That's not everybody. I mean, I agree with that. Write your MP, say, I would love it if you would vote for the ratification amendment. And I think there will be MPs who will be really chary about walking through the lobby with the Tories and voting for Theresa May's deal. And they need to know that we get why they're doing that. Because that's the really difficult thing about this, is that you do have to vote for the withdrawal agreement if you want the ratification amendment.
So my big concern is essentially the Remainers get too caught up in the mechanism. So people's vote, final say, whatever you want to call it, send it back to the people. And in Parliament, everyone's also caught up in different mechanisms of delivering Brexit. Yeah. And what's being lost is the values-based arguments about whether this is a good or bad idea. And that doesn't prepare us that well for the actual referendum in terms of the debate and messaging.
I'm completely prepared for the actual referendum. Do you want to know? On a values basis, I think the best argument for the ratification referendum is that this is the way unions negotiate. And let's face it, nobody really knows more about trade negotiations than a union. But this is the way they do it. They get a deal for the workers. They go back to the members. Then the members say yes, then they go back and sign the deal. That's always the way it's been done. And I've heard a few arguments like Good Friday Agreement, this is the way the Good Friday Agreement was done. I don't think that's a good enough argument because nobody remembers how that was done. But everybody understands how a union works and there is a kind of, you know, groundswell for that. That's the best argument for the ratification referendum, as opposed to saying, no, let's carry on fighting for a second referendum. In the referendum itself, I'm going to go with 33%, this is what we need to do to reform Europe, you know, carbon-free continent by 2050, wage floor across borders, you know, solidarity across borders, a kind of policy on migration and refugees, a kind of remade and remodeled socialism across borders in the spirit of the, you know, original roots of European federalism. That's 33%. 33% fix Britain instead, which is that Tom Cabezi from the IPPR idea, really. Why are we doing this when there is so much to fix about Britain and so much potential we could unlock and so much wonderful, productive, pro-social acts we could do if we weren't mired in this bollocks? And then 33%, if you don't ever want to hear about Brexit again, as long as you live, you need to vote against it. That's the only way out. Mm. You know, we could get Theresa May's deal, we could get no deal, we could get Corbyn's fantasy deal. In any of those scenarios, we're talking about trade deals for the next 20 years.
Yeah, I don't think people realize to what extent we're talking about a process that's going to affect the next 20, 30 years politically. So I do think that that's a really strong argument, because that's the answer to get on with it right?
And also, it's just
what they throw in our face.
But it's also a really playful spirit to that argument. It's like, do you really want to be this bored for the next 2 decades of your life? You know, there's a very serious point. You know, do you really want austerity to continue completely unscrutinized? Do you really want people to carry on getting poorer and carry on without hope and carry on being screwed by the benefit system while we talk about Brexit? But there's also a very playful point. This is killing me. I hate it. I want to talk about something else. And I think that has been really missing from politics of, you know, since 2010, actually, with that kind of very aerated Tory nostalgia language, it's kind of which relies on humorlessness. You cannot go on about belt tightening and harking back to the Second World War as a kind of golden age of British personality with a sense of humour. You can't do it. So we've had this kind of enforced humourlessness for nearly 9 years now, and I would love it if we could get some humour back into it.
One of the things that we also really need to address head on, I reckon, is this ratification amendment and referendum idea basically disenfranchises, or this is the criticism, the people who want a no deal Brexit. What do you think about that?
Well, whether or not having no deal on the ballot is disenfranchising to them.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking about this yesterday. People talk about having no deal on the ballot as though it's, you know, similar to or analogous with having a referendum on the death penalty. Why would you give people such a horrible choice? Why would you open up such a nasty, diseased casket? But I think it's more like giving people a choice about whether to unleash smallpox on the population. There are a lot of people, evidently, who think... There was a guy on Channel 4 News who said, I think it would be good for us to go without food because it will make people remember what they had. When what they had was food. You know, there is a constituency of people who want to inflict pain on their fellow citizens. But I just don't think that should be an option.
I actually, you know, I've been on my own little journey with this referendum idea. And I think the no deal option is something that if you think about what we've been going through for the last 3 years as a really bad idea executed really poorly, the one learning outcome for everyone is surely that no deal doesn't work. It doesn't really exist as an actual outcome that can deliver any benefits for anyone. There's no point in putting something like that to a vote. It's like putting, let's dissolve the country or let's burn down our houses. There will always be maniacs who vote for burning down the houses, but that's not what we want.
Well, yeah, I think that's interesting because you're both focusing on the consequences of no deal and saying that they're so catastrophically bad that they just can't really be countenanced. But I think that there's another argument, which is about how do you actually define no deal? And I think this is the biggest problem for me for putting it on the ballot paper. I mean, if in the real world, practically no deal happens, within 10 days, there would be a deal. So what you're asking for is and would that deal then be a violation of the will of the people? I mean, strictly speaking, it would. And this is what people are saying in Brussels all the time. They recognise completely that the EU will have more negotiating power in the event of a no deal situation because Britain will be in a cataclysmic breakdown of social order and will sign any deal they are offered in order to get the show back on the road and to get the pharmaceutical medicines into the country and get the trade flowing and all of this stuff. I think you could speculate on what the worst deal would look like, but one thing that the EU would probably include is open access to fishing waters, something that, you know, they haven't included in the withdrawal treaty at the moment, but is really controversial in France and Spain, and probably just making Britain pay more money on the basis of compensation for the cataclysmic effects of the crisis in mainland Europe as well. So it's a kind of, it would put the Tory government delivering it in this Greek Tsipras kind of situation. If you didn't accept this deal 2 months ago, you've caused all of this contagion and risk in the Eurozone, and now we're going to give you a worse deal. So if you have like an unromantic sense of the EU, which I do, and like I'm pro-European, but I'm not, you know, like we all are, we don't have great illusions in what it's like, then, you know, they're not like super nice guys who are just going to like turn around and go, hey, Britain, it's fine. You caused this massive shipwreck, but you know what? We're such a benign international institution. We're going to help you out now. It's not going to happen.
It's funny. I never think about the emotional kind of element of the European position, partly because they're not one nation. You kind of think of them as having been stripped of any kind of psychodynamic dimension. But actually, of course, they're going to be really annoyed.
I mean, this is, even if you think about it, it's just a, you know, a trade transaction, you know, as a partnership in a trading bloc.
Yeah.
One partner does something that causes financial damage, which this is going to cause both sides. Of course, you're not going to just wave that off. You hand them the invoice and be like, sign here. This is the money you owe me for this traffic jam I have of lorries in Calais or whatever.
Just to return briefly, though, to the democratic question, the thing which is giving no deal as much air as it does have is the number of people who support it, you know, which obviously is stupid. I mean, it's obviously stupid, it's something to be taken seriously from a democratic perspective, that if you then have the ratification referendum, which can only be Theresa May's deal or let's not leave, people will kick off. I think you just have to front it out.
But look, the first rule of opinion polls is that people are always confused. And especially about complicated questions, because we also know from the polls that Theresa May's actual deal is weirdly unpopular. Mm. So there's a democratic case for staying in the EU on the basis of that too. There's not that much scope in the country for the compromise that her deal
represents. Nobody wants a compromise. But look, I'm really, really tired of like only Leavers anger being taken seriously, only far right activism being taken seriously. There's a kind of highly emotional case made on Leave's behalf, which nobody makes on Remain's behalf at all. You know, it's like our anger doesn't mean anything because we'll just chatter about it in chattering areas.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you know, Lloyd Russell Moyle has been saying in these meetings in Parliament that some group of Labour MP Remainers have been organising. Whether there is a referendum or whether the Labour Party and other parties just put it in their manifesto that they're going to stop Brexit, to be honest, at this stage in the country's debate and the crisis, I don't think the mechanism is that important anymore. You just need to make the values-based argument that this is just a bad idea and we should have nothing to do with it.
I think it's also worth remembering why no deal is so popular, because no deal is essentially a slogan. Like, no deal is a really successful, very loud message that is coming from the Leave campaign, which never stopped. You know, after it won that referendum, it never stopped and it continued going on and pumping messages out. The same way as this idea that Theresa May's deal is very unpopular because people actually had a look at it and decided this is not what they wanted. That's not true. That's just part of a really successful messaging operation that has transformed Take Back Control into no deal. That's the words, that's the slogan, and that's what people, you know, attach their various frustrations to. They don't necessarily have a critical analysis of Theresa May's deal and why it's that bad.
It's just a big FU to Europe, isn't
it? I know you only want to talk about values. But I want to just stay on the ratification amendment for two more points. One is, how likely is it to get through? And two is, what's likely to derail it?
I think the Tory split helps, because I think Tory Remainers will be more confident in sort of moving out and voting for it.
Okay,
so I think that puts us in a stronger position.
How many Labour people definitely won't vote for it, and how many Tories do we need?
I think you need about 20 Tories. But you've banked three from the split.
Yeah.
So then you need another 17 or so.
Okay.
And you need a strong Labour vote. So I don't think it's inconceivable. I think it's in play.
And are we likely to lose more Labour people than just, you know, the four who we always lose?
I think, yes, potentially we are.
That's a problem. That's why the majority now is only 8 with the split. Right. May's majority, DUP plus Tories. But 20 Tory MPs or 18, 17, that puts you in the level to manage the Labour inevitable, probably Labour rebellion of a similar size.
And secondly, what could happen between now and next Wednesday that would change the picture?
If you're in a seat with a Tory Remainer, for God's sake, send them a bleeding heart Liberal email saying, don't do this, for goodness sake, step back from the brink. I voted Remain, you voted for Remain, vote for the ratification amendment.
I think it's attracting more collaborators in the redrafting process, so it will probably come out as something slightly different.
Slightly different, yeah, exactly.
In a good way.
That's fine, yeah.
And Another Europe have got Days of Action.
Of course, yeah, yeah. We're always out and about on Days of Action. We are, as usual, focusing on MPs that are rightly or wrongly a bit wobbly on this issue. So we are urging locals, Labour members, supporters, just affected and disgruntled constituents to get out there and urge others to write letters and send any form of communication they can to these MPs, because now's the time for them to basically stand up for something.
Yeah, so this week is really key, to be honest. It's like delay Article 15, new referendum is going to be the whole situation. Stands on a knife edge.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really not interested in delaying Article 50. It will have to be extended if we get the ratification amendment passed, and we'll have to revoke it if we don't get a deal through. But I don't think extending it on its own merit without any other plan.
Well, that's the problem with the proposal. It's extend for what, you know?
Extend,
I mean, I suppose the aim is to take no deal off the table, which is totally reasonable.
But it doesn't take no deal off the table, does it? It just means that we spend more and more time fighting about no deal.
That's inevitable.
I just can't bear it. And what do you think? How hopeful do you feel? Like, you can give me a percentage hope or anything.
Okay, I would say I have about 33% hope, 33% like pure despair, and the rest of it is anger. And I think the anger can combine quite well with the hope element for now, with the hope element, and I actually can push through quite a lot. I mean, we can still achieve quite a lot in the very short time that we're
That's actually a very interesting psychoanalytic point, that you can attach your anger to your hope or your despair and create something quite different.
because you know, the anger will need to be there to drive whatever comes next. So I'm not trying to squash it. I'm just trying to direct it into a more productive...
Yeah.
So in the spirit of pessimism of the intellect, I would therefore say I think the country is in a pretty difficult place. There's massive support for no deal, and the forces of hope have to fight really hard and really energetically to stop a car crash exit from the European Union. I mean, just imagine, like, it'll be sort of Versailles treaty level disaster, the deal that the UK signs 10 days after crashing out of the EU without a deal. Because what it will mean is, in pubs up and down the country, the narrative will be effing Europe, like, these bastards, you know, all of this stuff. It will be a disaster. So we have to stop no deal, and I think we can. So I have a bit of intellectual optimism there. And whether we can stop Brexit, I would give us a 1 in 3 chance.
Really? 1 in 3?
Yeah, so two in three, yeah, that's pretty good odds.
I think the ratification referendum is going to work.
Great.
And so, I'm giving it 2 and 3, if not 7 and 10.
Oh, you're always so optimistic.
Aww.
I know, but listen, we're still here, aren't we?
Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for listening. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please tell someone about it. Better still, leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. You can also feedback to us on Twitter at @another_Europe. Or you can find us at facebook.com/AnotherEuropeIsPossible. We'll be back very soon. See you then.